You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
The doors are about to open. We hear the cheering. We're about a minute away.
It's late September 2023. At the Apple Store on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, people are lined up around the block, waiting to be the first to buy the latest iPhone 15.
And now, here's Tim Cook. He's right behind the doors. We might be able to see him right now. Door's about to open. Let's take
With all the fanfare, you'd think it was a movie premiere.
Looks like a lot of people are taking selfies with Tim Cook. He's definitely the celebrity drop there.
He is. This is the routine we've been going through for 16 years now since the first iPhone launched, and people are still lining up, still want to take selfies. I'm reminded.
I actually met this celebrity once in 2015 in the elegant dining room on the top floor of the State Department. I was reporting on a lunch for the leader of China, Xi Jinping. I was standing off to the side, minding my business, my MacBook Air open in my hand, when the man himself, Tim Cook, wanders up. He's slim, trimmed gray hair, nice laptop, he says, a big smile on his face, playing that ever-familiar role, charming diplomat. Relations between the U.S. and China were warm back in 2015, and relations between Apple and China were even warmer. But as things have gone south between Washington and Beijing, they've turned a bit sour for Apple, too. I'm Jane Perlez, and this is Face Off, a series about the up-and-down relationship between the U.S. and China. This week on the podcast, the marriage between two of the most secretive organizations in the world, the Chinese Communist Party and Apple. We'll hear from a supply chain expert and a journalist who broke a wild story about Apple's dealings in China. Plus, we'll hear from China historian Rana Mitter.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Steve Jobs introduced the first iPhone in 2007, and true to form, it was a revolutionary product. Today, Apple makes about 230 million iPhones a year. It has become a global status symbol. In order to keep up with demand and be profitable, Apple needed to find a manufacturing partner.
So I'll tell you a story here.
Willie Shih is a professor at the Harvard Business School and a supply chain expert. He spent decades in the tech industry setting up factories in Asia, and he remembers quite vividly when companies like Compaq, IBM, Apple, and Dell made the shift from the U.S. to Asia.
I remember going to Taiwan in the early 1990s, where they were making the motherboards for desktop personal computers, and I asked the plant manager, how much profit do you make assembling these motherboards? And he told me at the time he made maybe $8 for each one, out of which he had to pay all his factory labor and overhead. So he was not making a lot of money. And my reaction at the time was, that's terrible. What are you going to do about this business? And he pointed to the machines that were placing components on circuit boards. He said, you see all these machines. He said, we have a new technology, which is much, much cheaper. He said, it's called HMT, hand mount technology. Instead of paying $100,000 for one of these machines, what we do is we send these circuit boards over to China and we hire 18-year-olds who solder the components by hand. And that was when I first realized that there was something to this China manufacturing model, which was really about low cost of labor.
In the 1990s, she says you could pay factory workers less than 50 cents an hour.
There was the saying back then, any problem you had, you threw labor at the problem. Because you could hire what at the time seemed like an unlimited supply of labor to solve any problem that you needed.
Taiwanese manufacturers took advantage of that. Chief among them, Terry Goh and his company Foxconn. Foxconn manufactured that first iPhone back in 2007 and has been involved in making almost all iPhones since. It's key to Apple's iPhone success.
I would argue that Terry Goh and Foxconn were very good at scaling this Chinese manufacturing model.
Former Apple executives brag about how Foxconn, with the backing of the local government, cut down a mountain to build one of its factories in China. The biggest Foxconn factory employs and houses and feeds somewhere around 300,000 workers. Think of a factory complex roughly the population of Tampa, Florida. It's huge, massive. Willie Shi says what made Terry Goh and his Taiwanese company Foxconn so successful in China were two distinct advantages.
They took advantage of the fact that they shared a common language with the workforce. They had a common cultural heritage. They understood where the opportunities were. So they understood that they could marshal huge numbers of workers to put together products on demand.
One of the most thorough reporters on the relationship between the U.S. and China is Wayne Ma, a correspondent for the tech business news outlet, The Information. Ma has covered every inch of the Apple China beat and broken some great stories, if I may say so. And I wanted to get his views on how we got here and where this relationship is headed.
So I wanted you to sort of tell us about how you see the relationship between Apple and the Chinese government in the early days and mid days of Apple's manufacturing in China. Would you say, for example, that Apple was the heavy in the relationship?
Yes. In the early 2000s, when Apple was scaling up production of the iPod, when the iPod was becoming much more popular, they couldn't build it anymore in Taiwan because they just couldn't get that scale. And so Foxconn provided them the in to do it in China. And at that time, China was desperate for foreign investment. It's desperate for manufacturing knowledge. And so they were more than willing to welcome Apple with open arms into China and give Apple and Foxconn whatever they wanted. Once the iPhone came out, it was the same thing. The government at the time wanted to show that it was friendly to foreign investors, friendly to foreign companies. You know, they wanted Chinese consumers to get access to foreign products. And so Apple also, it was a lot easier for them to operate in China and to offer services like music and movies or messaging. But all that has gradually changed.
I think it's important for us to maybe think about when the relationship between China and Apple changed. I would say from my reporting, 2016 was a pretty pivotal year. That was the year when I think China said, okay, Apple, you've got to keep all the Chinese data inside China. And that's the year when they started to take Western apps off the App Store. So Instagram, Reddit, Western news organizations like the New York Times, Wall Street Journal had to be taken off, and Apple complied.
Yeah, 2016 was a very pivotal year for Apple. That was the year they shut down the iBooks and iTunes movie stores in China. Apple had just launched them 7 months prior, and it was a huge surprise to them when they were told they couldn't operate them. That was something that executives back in Cupertino just couldn't fathom. And that really shocked Apple into reassessing its relationship with China and how it approached the Chinese government.
And do you think Apple tried in the beginning to argue with Beijing? Did they fight back at all?
They definitely tried to use government relations to smooth things over and gain exceptions to some of these things. They were reaching out to government officials, taking meetings. But the big weapon they had was Tim Cook. and the ability to send him to China regularly to meet with government officials.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the big events, I think, in this long relationship is in 2016, when Tim Cook and his lieutenants went to Zhongnanhai. Now, you and I both know what that is. That's the headquarters in Beijing of the Chinese Communist Party. It's right next to the Forbidden Palace in Beijing. The photos from that time when Tim Cook went, he looks really stern, and his lieutenants look really stern. It's an unusual photograph. What do you think the Apple team was doing there?
Well, based on my reporting, they had drafted this agreement called a Memorandum of Understanding, and basically it pledged to kind of help Beijing and China kind of further their technological and economic ambitions. And so Apple drafted this, like, 1,200-word agreement that wasn't technically legally binding, but it was sort of a roadmap to how they would kind of approach their relationship with China in the coming years. It was a 5-year agreement. Basically, it promised that Apple would try to use more Chinese companies in its supply chain, try to establish R&D centers, aid education, software development, and the environment as well. And this committed Apple to doing this for at least 5 years, if not more. And one key phrase was that they promised to spend many billions more per year than what they had spent overall in China in 2015.
I think the total that you reported was they pledged to spend $275 billion over 5 years.
Yeah, that's correct. So they had kind of calculated that that would be the amount that they would spend over that period, whether it was for running their retail stores, or for buying components, or for paying workers, you know, at Foxconn. You know, that was what they felt was their total economic contribution to China.
I mean, $275 billion is just an incredible amount of money, even for the world's most valuable company, I would say. And you broke that story. I have to say, as reporter to reporter, I'm very, very envious that you were able to do that. This deal ran from 2017 to 2022, if I remember correctly.
I mean, I didn't know there was an agreement. I knew that there were all these different pledges that Apple had made over the years, but it wasn't until I could meet with sources to ask them, you know, what sort of documents they had, did I really stumble upon this agreement and realize that this kind of explains all of their moves over the last 5 years. Now, it makes a lot of sense, right? It was able to connect the dots and figure out what all these individual moves were, you know, was through the covering of this document.
And I think there's words in that document, according to your story, that talk about Apple doing training for Chinese tech companies. What does that involve?
So this is one thing that Apple has been trying to promote with the Chinese government, is that even though it doesn't enter into business partnerships with Chinese companies or give them majority control of any sort of operations, it is constantly sending engineers to all these factories in China that are building its components and parts and assembling its iPhones. And those engineers are passing on the knowledge, their knowledge of technology and manufacturing, to a whole new generation of Chinese engineers. And so this is what Apple was trying to emphasize with the Chinese government, is that they were actually giving back to China in this way.
But doesn't that risk hurting Apple? Because these engineers can leave the Apple plants and go to Xiaomi, which is an indigenous Chinese phone, or to Huawei, an even bigger Chinese company, and pass on the tech expertise that they've learned at the Apple factory. It sounds as though Apple is, in fact, encouraging the growth of Chinese local brands.
I mean, at the end of the day, this type of knowledge is very difficult to pinpoint who owns it and how to control it. I mean, of course, Apple has their proprietary IP, but manufacturing knowledge, like how to fit something in a jig, or keep it clamped down properly, or how to build a metal tool or a injection molding mold. These are all things that, unfortunately, are transferable, that Apple doesn't have any proprietary control over that. And so there is a limit to what Apple can kind of control, but this is part of the price you pay for outsourcing. Inevitably, there will be this kind of knowledge transfer. The rules are kind of porous.
And you know, it was fascinating to me that Apple just sort of like flick of a finger said, okay, you're right. Sharing service, Didi, which is the equivalent of Uber, we'll give them $1 billion. What was that about? That was in the agreement.
Yeah, so part of the agreement, actually, Apple committed to helping to fund Chinese startups. That agreement coincided a few days previously with Apple announcing this $1 billion investment in Didi, which at the time was one of, you know, China's most valuable startups.
So by this stage, then, it sounds as though the relationship has quite changed, and China has become the heavy in the relationship.
Yeah, that's very true. With the rise of Xi Jinping, he's gradually exerted more control over foreign companies, data, content, the internet in general. And a lot of that has had a huge impact on Apple's ability to operate in China in the way it did before. So for example, apps. There's lots of apps that used to be available that the Chinese government didn't enforce the fact that they needed licenses to operate or partners in China to operate. And all of that's kind of going away, and Apple's had to remove thousands of apps from its app store to comply with Chinese laws. Services like Apple TV can't be launched in China without a joint venture partner now, whereas in the past, Apple was able to launch Apple Music by itself.
So in the last couple of years, Foxconn hasn't had it so easy, actually. The Chinese government has, perhaps you could say, stopped doling out favors to Foxconn and is favoring another company called Luxshare. And what's interesting about Luxshare is it's Chinese-owned. It's not owned by Taiwanese. And the owner of Luxshare is a very interesting woman, Grace Wang, who sits on one of the important committees of the Communist Party. What can you tell us about Grace? What kind of character is she?
So the interesting thing about Grace and Luxshare is that Grace Wang actually started as an employee at Foxconn. This happens a lot. Like people work at one Apple supplier and then they decide to go out on their own and they suddenly become a competitor. Luxshare has kind of bought its way into Apple's supply chain by gradually acquiring companies that were doing business with Apple and also starting with very rudimentary components in Apple supply chain before moving up the ladder to more complex assembly and products. And so it started offering or selling lightning cables and other kind of cables to Apple and making them. And it slowly began assembling accessories for Apple, such as battery packs and air tags. Now it's actually assembling not only the iPhone, but its Vision Pro mixed reality headset. So you've kind of watched it gradually kind of move up the value chain in just a matter of 5 years. The other interesting thing about Luxshare is that because it's a Chinese company, it tends to be favored more by local governments. It has, you know, better access to subsidies and other benefits that Foxconn doesn't. If you remember Foxconn, when they entered China in the early 2000s, there were no competing Chinese companies. It was all foreign companies. Chinese companies really didn't have much advantage or could really compete. But now the whole relationship's flipped. And now you're seeing all these Chinese companies supplant Taiwanese companies and other companies that are operating in China.
And it sounds as though Grace herself is quite a character. Can you describe her?
Yeah, I've talked to people at Luxshare who used to work at Luxshare who say that she's incredibly down to earth. That's opposed to Terry Goh, who's kind of not seen as approachable and almost a godlike figure. You know, Grace has been known to walk the production lines, walk the halls of the factory, greet people, talk to them one-on-one, get to know them. Someone told me a story about how she sent her private car to pick somebody up from the airport because it wasn't being used. Or when she was in the Bay Area, she told people, oh, make sure to finish all your plates. You know, you don't want to waste food. This is just a huge contrast to Goh, and it just shows like how different these new wave of Chinese entrepreneurs and billionaires are. I mean, she's a billionaire now.
I bet that car that went to the airport wasn't just any car.
Who knows, but it's probably black because that's usually what all the Chinese officials drive.
Let's talk about Apple under pressure to diversify because the relationship has changed. China's much more in control than it was. Tim Cook was at a state dinner for the leader of India. He was there when Modi showed up at the White House. They are trying to diversify to India, it seems. And how is that going? And how long will it take them to really get a substantial business going in India?
Apple's superpower has always been its ability to manage its supply chain in China and ship those products from China to the rest of the world. That's how it has been able to keep its margins high and become profitable. That whole relationship is changing now for a variety of reasons. At first, it was supply chain risk with labor issues, trying to, you know, not concentrate everything in China, but to kind of look at other places like India and Vietnam, where conditions are different, workers might be different. But then with the election of President Trump and the increased friction between the United States and China, then it became a diversification because of trade risk, trade tariffs, you know, economic blockades, that sort of thing. Then when COVID happened, suddenly it became clear There's also issues with natural disasters and pandemics. And you have to worry about lockdowns in different countries and different policies. And so because of all these reasons, Apple has accelerated its efforts to diversify away from China. But it's very difficult. The company, you know, doubled, if not tripled down on China over the last, you know, 5-10 years. And to unwind that is pretty impossible. The most they can do is probably shift a portion of their production out of China to countries like Vietnam and India. But all those places are very different in terms of what they offer. You know, Vietnam has good engineering talent, but not enough people. India has lots of people, but not good enough infrastructure. And culturally, India is very different than China in terms of work ethic, hours worked, and also the motivation for people to leave their families and leave their hometowns and travel far distances, you know, migrant workers to work at these factories, which is, you know, very prevalent in China, but not in India. So Apple faces all these challenges, and it's not very clear how successful they will be in diversifying.
How long do you think it will take them to get a reasonable percentage of their phones manufactured in India?
I think maybe it might take anywhere from 5 to 10 years, if not more, to have a significant amount shift over.
But in any event, it does look as though the tight marriage between Apple and China is facing a breakup, or if not a severe breakup, the very least is becoming an open marriage.
Right, that's right. So you would say they had an exclusive relationship with their own levels of bickering. It was a good marriage. It may have been an arranged marriage, but it worked. Now it looks like it's more of an open marriage.
Wayne, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you, and we really appreciate your deep reporting and incredible expertise on all things Apple and China. Thanks a lot.
No, thanks for having me.
Wayne Ma reports for the tech business outlet, The Information. You should definitely check out his reporting, especially the story that he broke about the $275 billion deal that Apple made with the People's Republic of China. We'll put links to that article in our show notes. It makes for really interesting reading. Up next, noted China historian Rana Mitta joins me for his reflections.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, and I hope you'll join me on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Every Thursday, I'm getting the inside take from the best reporters in the country on what figures like Elon Musk, Donald Trump, Kevin McCarthy, and Marjorie Taylor Greene are doing.
I think she wants to make things happen. She wants to get legislation passed. She made clear to me that she wants to have a president who upholds Christian values. She embraces the term Christian nationalist.
That's Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair, available wherever you get your podcasts.
We started the podcast with Steve Jobs talking about this revolutionary product, the iPhone, that changed the world. But as we heard with Wayne Ma, things are getting tricky for Apple in China. My friend, historian Rana Mitta, is here to talk about what's next for this unusual relationship. So, Rana, Apple has had a really great ride in China. It's been a long ride, and it's been an incredibly favorable ride. But Washington, which obviously respects Apple a lot, is getting very impatient because they're turning so much against China. They're saying, what? How is Apple doing so well? Why are they so dependent on China? And some are beginning to ask, what would happen if we asked Apple, are you for China or are you for the United States? A loyalty test. If you were Apple, what would you say?
I think I would say, if a congressman is asking me this question, Congressman, do you have an iPhone? Do you remember the iPhone that you had in 2010 and the one that you have now? Well, one of the reasons that the one you have in your hand right now is so much better is that we've invested so much time and money in China. All of that has been, in the end, to the benefit of Americans who have been able to have the benefit of iPhone technology.
Do you think the relationship is sustainable?
I think that actually the likelihood is that China is going to do what it does to plenty of other Western companies and basically keep enough of the door open to mean that Apple has an interest, as Volkswagen does, as BASF does, as Ford does, as a whole variety of Western corporates do, in making sure that they are not completely excluded from the China market. In other words, the Chinese government could, essentially chuck everyone out. After all, they did that in, you know, that period between 1949 and 1952 when Mao took over. Pretty much every foreign company, sooner rather than later, was sent out. But I don't think that's going to happen. The reason being that, of course, if China really makes sure that all these big corporates, and there's none bigger than Apple, is out the door, then the leverage stops. There's no possibility for China to be able to go to a corporation and say, you want to keep in the Chinese market, or you want access to what we can do in terms of assembly or technology, if they're completely excluded from the market. And that means that there's always going to be, or for some time, there will be a balancing act on the Chinese side in which they make it clear that they want to make as much of their production indigenous as possible over the longer term. I think they'd rather have fewer foreign brands, not more, in China. But in the medium term, they're not going to scare off the best case they still have for the Western world engaging with China.
Yes, but don't you think that Chinese government, meaning the Chinese Communist Party in this sense, are going to really want their premier homegrown brand, Huawei, which has been battered by the West, which has been kept out of Western markets, don't you think they're going to want Huawei to really shine? And Huawei is beginning to shine. Their latest phone is faster than people expected. I'm just wondering if Beijing is going to have second thoughts about Apple being around because Huawei is beginning to reach the excellence where they need to be on their own.
I think there are several things tied up in that, Jane. First of all, of course, the quality of Huawei phones, from what we know about them, and it's harder to get them in the West these days, fewer people have them than would have been the case even just a few years ago. But from what we know, they do seem to be high spec and to be very effective phones. And I think it's likely that they will dominate the market, obviously not just at home in China, but actually in many emerging markets where Huawei, and also Xiaomi, which actually is the other brand, which has a lot more purchase in relatively new entry markets, may get a pretty large share of the market in those sorts of areas. That, I think, is happening already. But the other reason, it seems to me, that people choose an Apple phone, an iPhone, and this is true, I think, in the wider world, not just in China, is that it's also associated with a particular set of brand values. That's much harder to reproduce. One thing that China has managed to do over time very, very well is to reproduce technology from elsewhere, cars, phones, whatever it might be. But so far, I think it's hard to say, with a very few exceptions, that China has produced a global brand that people think is prestigious. Now, the nearest thing I can think of, it's not quite the same thing, is, of course, TikTok, you know, the one Chinese-driven app.
There's BYD, the EV that some people think is going to absolutely dominate the world market in electric vehicles.
Yeah, but it hasn't dominated the world market of vehicles just yet. And I would say at this stage, I could think of an awful lot of middle-class Chinese who would say, do you want to buy an electric Chinese car or do you want an electric Mercedes? They're still going to choose the Benzi, to use the Chinese term for it. I think that, of course, Chinese brands are improving in quality, but also the desirability needs to be built on. But there's still some way to go, because in the end, brand awareness is about lots of things, but it's about image. And China still has a real problem in terms of creating a kind of soft power in which those brands thrive.
I want to ask you one last thing about the Apple phone. You know, the government has advised, urged, told state government employees in China not to bring their Apple phones to work. That sounds like a shot across the bow to me. What does it sound like to you?
It does sound like a bit like a shot across the bows. It's a reminder to the United States, if they're going to ban Chinese technology, TikTok, whatever it might be, from the American cybersphere, then China can do something similar. But think about the other side of what that story means, Jane. If they have to put out a statement of that sort, that means that large numbers, thousands, millions, I don't know, of China's rising bureaucrats, all with their own money and their own preference, went and bought an Apple iPhone.
Yeah, it's millions, not thousands. I mean, the number of Apple iPhones that are sold every year, it's just astonishing.
And I can promise you it's not because the Chinese Communist Party is coming down and forcing people to buy iPhones. They're a consumer product that are in demand. Even Chinese bureaucrats are buying them. They may not be able to take them to work, but that doesn't mean they don't want one. That's what the CCP has to overcome. They're going to have to do more in terms of promoting their own brand than they are simply in banning people from buying an American brand.
Thank you, Rana. Great to talk today.
Thanks, Jane.
Ten, nine.
Our next episode covers a subject that I think a lot about, nuclear arms and China's race to increase its arsenal.
One. Keep off. Our nation's first atomic bomb is a success.
As China builds up its nuclear arsenal, how are we going to deal with a world where China and Russia are aligned against the United States?
The atomic bomb designed and made by our own nation is a complete success.
Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to Face Off anywhere you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, give us a review. This project is made possible by the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation. Face Off is produced and reported by me, Jane Perlez. Special guest, Rana Mitter. Executive producer, Mia Lobel. Senior producer, Nina Pozuki. Sound design and mixing by John Myers and Alex Lewis of Row Home Productions. Original score by Alex Lewis. Show art by Good Tape Studio. Research by Luz Deng. Special thanks to Paul Bogards and Maggie Taylor. Special thanks also to the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School for their support.
Row Home Productions.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, and I hope you'll join me on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Every Thursday, I'm getting the inside take from the best reporters in the country on what figures like Elon Musk, Donald Trump, Kevin McCarthy, and Marjorie Taylor Greene are doing.
I think she wants to make things happen. She wants to get legislation passed. She made clear to me that she wants to have a president who upholds Christian values. She embraces the term Christian nationalist.
That's Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair, available wherever you get your podcasts.